Notes from the Swan. In 18th century Britain, it was a mark of refinement and impeccable good taste to own and display a collection of fossils. Not only were the objects themselves rare and beautiful, well worthy of display in specially constructed glass cabinets, the simple possession of them hinted at a thirst for knowledge, an awareness of natural philosophy, a sympathetic understanding of the mysterious processes of the earth. And gradually it was from within the world of fossil hunting, a world that would soon be inhabited most prominently by William Smith, that the ideas emerged that would eventually lead Charles Darwin and Alfred Wallace to reach their profound conclusions about the origins of species. Perhaps for the British boulevardier in the 18th century, the interest in fossils was for their beauty and rarity, little more. The items, be they small or large, plant or animal, or merely the mysterious results of the fossil-making plastic force, would be displayed with reverence, handled with delicacy, viewed with awe. Collectors of fine jade today are a fair comparison with those of fossils 2 centuries ago, in that they're proud and protective, given to learning and, usually, the possession of some social standing. The clear and important difference is that the intricacies of objects made of jade are the artifice of human beings, while the strangely beautiful shapes and marks that delineate a fossil are the evidence, if ever in 18th century Britain there was agreement on this matter, of the work of God. The Dictionary of National Biography records the occurrence of the plural word fossils 293 times, and 177 prominent men and women from British history are listed as having had an interest in, or more likely a collection of, such treasures. Most of the listed collectors appear to have lived between the mid-18th and mid-19th centuries. Few people whose lives are otherwise worthy of recording seem to have collected fossils before 1700. As with postage stamps and coins, few contemporary amateur fossilists will admit to a mania for collecting them. Indeed, the fashion, for that is all it was, a fashion, began to die in mid-Victorian times. The spread of travel and a growing amazement with the outside world suddenly began to make anthropological souvenirs more valued as icons than dirt-encrusted items from Earth history. All of a sudden, drawing rooms became places to record and show off the material rewards of journeying through space, rather than the dusty and mysterious objects that came from journeying through time. What had hitherto been a signifier of drawing-room decorum seemed overnight to become the pastime of the dull, and then steadily to evolve into what amateur paleontology is now, no more than the mark of the nerd. There's much to learn from the DNB about the nature and habits of one-time fossil collectors. The 177 entries show the typical collector of the time to have had certain outward similarities of background, knowledge, and social standing. Most of them, this being the less sexually enlightened end of the 19th century, happened to be men, although by chance it was a young Dorset woman who was perhaps the most famous fossil collector of them all. Mary Anning was 30 years younger than William Smith, and there's no record that the pair ever met, but her birthplace and scene of all her paleontological triumphs, the small seaside town of Lyme Regis, evidently interested Smith. In one of his notebooks there's a rough sketch map of the lower Jurassic sea cliffs there, dated 1794, 5 years before Mary Anning was born. Her life was short indeed, even by the standards of the day, and yet the fact that she survived a lightning strike, which killed 3 adults, when she was just 1 year old, always lent locals a suspicion that hers would be an eccentric and furious one. Most of it she spent carefully prying choice specimens of fossil creatures from the Lias Cliffs near her home. Her father had taught her something of fossil gathering, since his own business was the making of the very cabinets in which the well-heeled local collectors would keep their own specimens. Her best-known find is the original ichthyosaur, a massive confection of shiny brown bones she first disposed of to the Duke of Buckingham, and which is now carefully reconstructed in London's Natural History Museum. She was only 12 when she found it, only 22 when she discovered a juvenile specimen of the huge marine reptile later named a plesiosaur, and not yet 30 when she found a near-perfect specimen of the bird progenitor, the pterodactyl, and sent it off to Oxford. For a while, this untutored young woman made a sizeable income, either by selling fossils to visitors, for whom Lyme Regis is still a major tourist centre today, or leading would-be collectors to the cliffs to find specimens for themselves. The names of her customers are like a roll call of the leading geologists of the day. William Conybeare, Sir Henry de la Biche, who lived nearby, Dean William Buckland. But slowly the popular craze for collecting began to wane, and by 1847, when Mary Anning died at the age of 48 of breast cancer, she had been all but forgotten and had passed into obscurity. De la Biche, who went on to become the first director of the British Geological Survey, drew a fanciful cartoon for her, showing what Dorset might have looked like in the Middle Jurassic, with enormous and rather genial-seeming monsters rising from the steaming deeps. The drawing became rather popular, and Sir Henry made sure that all the proceeds went to Mary to help this modest heroine of the science as her fortunes began to decline. There was another woman geologist and collector whose name does not figure in the existing DNB, but perhaps should. She was Etheldred Bennett, a great-granddaughter of a 17th-century Archbishop of Canterbury. She was born in 1776, and she definitely did meet William Smith. Indeed, she gave him a piece of the well-known Tisbury coral, of which she was England's best-known collector. She made a specialty of exploring the Middle Cretaceous Upper Greensand in the Vale of Warder, in Wiltshire. As a relative wrote, while other ladies of her time were doing needlepoint and chattering over cups of India tea, she became competent at systematic scientific research, as well as the vigorous fieldwork of fossil hunting. She had a monograph, privately printed, a catalogue of the organic remains of the county of Wiltshire. All evidence suggests she died a maiden aunt. Her family insisted that one of the specimens later placed in her collection, nestled among her sponges and her corals, and thanks presumably to a cooperative undertaker, was her own heart, unbroken but quite petrified, transformed to resemble a stone, as a geologist's heart perhaps deserves to be. Most amateur collectors were comfortably established, for fossil collecting was widely seen as a fashion for gentlemen of leisure. Men like, for example, the redoubtable Sir John St. Aubyn, 5th Baronet, Sheriff of Cornwall until his death in 1839, a Grand Master of the Freemasons, and a man who augmented his immense collection of minerals by buying for £100 the entire fossil collection of the remarkable Richard Green of Lichfield. Green, so far as we know, was a like-minded swell who had amassed, to the approval of his friend and relative and neighbour, Samuel Johnson, a houseful of coins, crucifixes, watches, minerals, orreries, deeds and manuscripts, missals, muskets and specimens of armour, as well as hundreds of ancient shells, graptolite etchings and ammonites made of iron pyrite. Then there was, at almost exactly the same time, the East India Company's naval officer, London banker and magnificently named Searles Valentine Wood the Elder, whose curiosity was first stirred while he was convalescing in Norfolk, but who, once recovered, embarked on a lifelong study of the fossil mollusks to be found in the construction sites of London. He was a member of a little-known body, the London Clay Club, and wrote book after book on his enormous collection of fossil bivalves, which he eventually donated to the British Museum. The Natural History Museum in South Kensington, where they rest today, is replete with the evidence of a century's worth of enthusiasms like Valentine's, collection after collection, testimony to the value of the amateur scientists who so flourished in this remarkable time in British history. Many of the most assiduous fossilists were what used to be called divines, a curious happenstance considering the assault that any intelligent understanding of fossils would later have on divinity's most firmly held notions like the creation and the flood. The Reverend Thomas Lewis of Ross-on-Wye is characteristic of the type. He's proud enough to offer a self-description, geologist and antiquary, rather than to note his formal position as the Vicar of Bridstow. His name may be forgotten by the curacy, but it is remembered in at least three Silurian fossil species that were named after him, all of them appropriately worthy, as may befit a clergyman, and rather dull. Many of the priestly collectors found in fossil hunting a much-needed intellectual stimulus, a relief from the unengaging topics that normally fill a country parson's life. The Reverend George Young, from the Scottish village of Coxydean, was a theologian attracted to the mysteries of fossils. He'd been taught by John Playfair, one of the giants of early academic geology, and he came to prominence in 1819 with his discovery in Yorkshire of a gigantic reptile ichthyosaur, since identified as Leptorhigius acuterostris. Though the find brought the enthusiastic Presbyterian minister some national fame, for a while he was held in almost the same esteem as Mary Anning, it equally confronted him with an interesting challenge, an acute mental and moral dilemma. It forced him to ponder two possibilities that his religious beliefs sternly discountenanced. Animal extinction on the one hand — there were no living ichthyosaurs, and so this particular species must have vanished — and animal evolution on the other. The crocodiles and dolphins to which this beast appeared to have been related were much less primitive than this, and so some advances must have taken place over time. The less fit and able must have been weeded out and left behind to die. Consideration of either of these possibilities was a heresy and an anathema to contemporary followers of the Bible, who regarded the Great Book, as do fundamentalists still today, of course, as nothing less than a documentary history of our planet. The Reverend Young was forced in consequence to engage in some interesting spiritual gymnastics to come to terms with the problem. He eventually committed his conclusions to paper in 1840 in a book with what might be considered the somewhat contradictory title Scriptural Geology. The science he advanced in it was not over-endowed with logic. The ichthyosaur he had found was not extinct, he declared, because a living specimen would probably be found sooner or later. When the seas and large rivers of our globe shall have been more fully explored, many animals may be brought to knowledge of the naturalist which at present are known only in the state of fossils. It would have amused Mr. Young greatly had he been alive over Christmas 1938, when the first coelacanth was found on the deck of a trawler newly come ashore in South Africa. He would doubtless have thought that this vindicated his otherwise dreamily unscientific view. As for evolution, Darwin's theory wasn't to be outlined for another 20 years, but men like Young, students of the realities of the fossil world, were already moving hesitantly towards the brink. "Some have alleged that in tracing the beds upwards we discern among the enclosed bodies a gradual progress from the more rude and simple creatures to the more perfect and completely organized, as if the Creator's skill had improved by practice. But for this strange idea there is no foundation. Creatures of the most perfect organization occur in the lower beds as well as in the higher." The Reverend Young could not, however, go any further than this. The forces ranged against him, of custom, history, doctrine, and common acceptance, were just far too formidable. My own favorite character, though sadly no more than a peripheral player in this story, is Samuel Woodward, a Norfolk collector and almost exact contemporary of Smith's, who worked for all of his 48 years in either an insurance office or a bank. He was fascinated by fossils and built up a large collection. He was not nobly born, however, nor could he have been described as a gentleman for whom paleontology was merely an idle pursuit for impressing the neighbours. He was ordinariness personified. His father had been a bombazine weaver, and his own apprenticeship was in the making of camlets. Smith would probably have liked him. Both were men of modest beginnings, for whom fossils were more a passion, less a pastime for the au courant. Yet it was not to be one of these modest men, but a number of the more gently born collectors and spiritual figures, whose influence was eventually to help place William Smith firmly on the flood tide of history. There was William Cunnington, a man still remembered around Devizes in Wiltshire as being the antiquary who excavated most of the ancient Long Barrows, with which the chalk downs of the county are littered. It was Cunnington who introduced Smith to the aforementioned Miss Bennet, who fascinated him with her collection of sponges and corals. The man who would later become the father of English geology thus briefly encountered the person who, in some circles at least, is thought of as English geology's first woman, if not quite, since she remained unmarried and was described as somewhat mannish, its mother. There was the Reverend Richard Warner, a great man for both writing and walking, but a figure who suffered severe and reiterated disappointments, for one of his books was judged a plagiary, another set of volumes was burned by mistake at the printer's, and someone dressed up as a gentleman, or so wrote William Smith, made off with his immense fossil collection by giving him a cheque that then promptly bounced. Then there was the somewhat happier Reverend Benjamin Richardson, the rector of the Somerset parish of Farley Hungerford. There was also Richardson's long-time friend, the Reverend Joseph Townsend, who was by calling a doctor and a Calvinist minister then living in Bath, who had been well and expensively educated at Cambridge and Edinburgh. Townsend had travelled widely in Spain and had brought back hundreds of fossils from the local limestones. He had not, Smith was later to write with relief, drawn any conclusions from his finds, and he was to remark later and ruefully, "Ah, Smith, were I now to go over to Spain again, I should give a very different account of the country." He would do so because, for the first time, William Smith was beginning to take a keenly intelligent interest in not just the rocks in the cuttings of the Coal Canal, but of the fossils too. And once he had begun to do so, then who better with whom to discuss his discoveries than the local worthies who had amassed collections themselves? His newfound social standing, his now close friendship with the widowed Lady Jones of Rugbourne, his relatively good financial condition, his ownership, even if mortgaged, of the small and pretty estate at Tucking Mill, his brief occupancy of a substantial terraced house in Bath itself, all these features commended the uneducated Smith to learned men like Townsend and Richardson, Cunnington and Warner, and allowed them to play a role in his life that he would later acknowledge as of huge importance. His work on the canal bed and its continuing line of progress was sometimes more confusing than it should be. Smith had no problem recognising the differences between most of the strata, true. There was a very obvious difference between the red marl and the coal measures, an equally obvious difference between the spawn-like granules in the limestones of the inferior oolite and the arenaceous beds of the lias. Yet some of the strata through which the excavators were making progress, particularly the finer-grained sandstones, looked too similar. From time to time it proved very difficult, Smith found, to differentiate one bed from another. In one cutting there may have been a sandstone, and in another, half a mile away, there may have been another that looked identical, and yet, to judge from a dip and a strike that didn't vary between the two outcrops, logic suggested that the two formations were not the same at all, had been laid down at different times, and were in fact separated by hundreds, perhaps even thousands, of feet of vertical distance. To understand the nature of this problem, it's perhaps easier to imagine something of the circumstances when the rocks were being laid down. Think, for example, of the conditions in the Lower and Middle Jurassic in North Somerset, something it's worth remembering that Smith would have been quite unable to imagine, since he had no idea of the ages of the rocks he examined, of the paleogeography of the region, of any of the concepts that permeate modern geology. He would not have known what modern science allows us to know, which is that for most of the 51-million-year period of time that began 208 million years ago, when the Jurassic period opens, most of North Somerset was covered by a shallow sea, at the western edge of a vast ocean called the Tethys. In addition, since all England was then positioned about 35 degrees north of the equator, the waters were subtropical and warm. But the sea in those days, much like the sea today, was not uniformly deep, and since it was at the edge of the Tethian Ocean, it was at times close to the land masses from which in places rivers cascaded or seeped, estuaries were formed, volcanoes erupted, cliffs collapsed, and where currents of sand and water swept down through deep ocean canyons. Paleogeography is a study that involves the constant remembrance of space and time, as well as all the physical conditions in which a particular rock type may be laid down, meaning that at any one time several different rock types may be being deposited or created at different places, and that over any extended period of time the very same rock, or at least rocks with the very same lithology, may be being laid down at different places. Hence the confusion. When William Smith was looking at the sandy outcrops of the Upper Lias in a few square miles around the village of Midford, say, he might find a succession of sandy beds in one valley, and another succession of sandy beds in another valley, that looked, to all intents and purposes, the same, but that his knowledge of their dip and strike and distance apart persuaded him were not the same at all, that the bed lying on top was younger than, that is, had been deposited more recently than, the bed that lay below. The conditions governing the type of rock, the facies, that had been laid down in each of these two valleys had been exactly the same. They had been deposited near the beach of a warm and shallow sea, with maybe some incoming muddy deposits from a nearby river. But their attitude, going back to the bread-and-butter analogy he had come up with back in his High Littleton days, still applied. They could not have been the same bed of rock, and they must have been separated by scores, maybe hundreds of feet, and hundreds of feet meant at the very least a long period of time. What the outcrops indicated was two different periods of time when the same conditions for deposit obtained. How, then, to tell these rocks apart? The answer lay in Smith's sudden realization that there was just one aspect of the two types of rock, and only one, that differed. The blocks of stone found in the cuttings may have all had the same color. An acid bottle would show them all to have the same chemistry. A magnifying glass would show the sandstones as all having the same grain size. But the fossils that were to be found in the two rocks, the bivalves, the ammonites, the gastropods, the corals, they were all subtly different. Every single one of the specimens of one kind of fossil might be the same throughout one bed, but would be subtly different from those of the same kind of fossil found in another bed. A period of time would have elapsed between the deposition of the two beds, and thus a period of time between the existence of the two kinds of animals it embraced. Evolution, we can say this today, but Smith had not even the vaguest conception of it back then, would have occurred. Those animals of which there would be fossilized remains that were found lower down in the series would be more primitive, those found in the rock layers above less so. But that was not the point. The important discovery that Smith made was that certain beds had certain fossils, that they were unique and peculiar to that bed and to that period of time in geologic history. They were never to be seen again in rocks that came later, in other words, in the rocks that appeared above. They were never seen before, either. They were peculiar, that is to say, to a certain and specific period in geologic time. They were the key to making a positive identification of what one rock might be in relation to any other. Day after day, during the late summer and autumn of 1795, whether he was working surveying the canal or simply clambering over rocks that interested him while his horse champed contentedly beside him, Smith tested and retested this theory. At each outcrop he came to, he would gingerly chip and pry and prize as many fossils as he could from their enfolding rock. Each evening he would take his specimens back to his elegant new terraced home in Bath. He would wash and dry each fossil, be it a pedestrian-looking oyster shell or the magnificent twirling fantasy of a full-blown ammonite, and he would lay each carefully on a pad of cotton, in drawer after drawer of his cabinets, carefully noting the rock, the horizon, the facies, and the lithology from which each came. And as his systematic collecting proceeded, and as the size and quality of his collection was daily enhanced, so his theory was confirmed and reconfirmed. A layer of rock, it now seemed incontrovertibly true, could be positively and invariably identified simply and solely by the fossils that were to be found within it. Wherever in the hills around Bath a sandstone appeared with a particular specimen of fossil enclosed within, then it was certain that it was the very same rock laid down at the very same time. And if this rock and fossil assemblage appeared not just in the hills around Bath, but in the valleys of Oxfordshire too, and was found in a quarry in Rutland, beside a road in Lincolnshire, on a peak near York, and finally in a cliff near Whitby, then it, too, was the self-same rock. Not just a similar rock, the same rock. And then, the corollary said, by joining the dots of its occurrence across the land, one could show just where this particular rock occurred all over the nation, and whether it made an outcrop or not. And one could do this not just in the nation, but in theory all over the world. One of the enigmas that was central to an unravelling of the mysteries of the planet had now demonstrably been solved. What Smith had vaguely imagined might be true when he looked through the mines near High Littleton was clearly an axiom, a fundamental fact of the new geological knowledge. And he, William Smith, was the first to say so. Smith was exultant at his realisation and committed his thoughts to paper with excited promptitude. He was in the Swan Inn in Dunkerton, sheltering from the cold on the evening of Tuesday, January the 5th, 1796. He had decided that evening not to brave the elements, not to go back home to Bath. He took a sheet of paper and wrote in his distinctively bold handwriting a single long sentence. The note survives, its underlining preserved for posterity. It was a sentence that of all he wrote is perhaps most deserving to be his epitaph. Fossils have long been studied as great curiosities, collected with great pains, treasured with great care, and at great expense, and showed and admired with as much pleasure as a child's rattle or a hobby horse is shown and admired by himself and his playfellows, because it's pretty. and this has been done by thousands who have never paid the least regard to that wonderful order and regularity with which nature has disposed of these singular productions and assigned to each class its particular stratum. Later, in more reflective mood, he would write, "For 6 years I put my notions of stratification to the test of excavation, and I generally pointed out to contractors and others who came to undertake the work what the various parts of the canal would be dug through. But the great similarity of the rocks of the Oolite, on and near the end of the canal towards Bath, required more than superficial observation to determine whether these hills were not composed of one, two, or even three of these rocks, as by the distinctions of some parts seemed to appear. These doubts were at length removed by more particular attention to the site of the organic fossils which I had long collected. This discovery of the mode of identifying the strata by the organized fossils respectively embedded therein led to the most important distinctions." In reflective mood, Smith seems more the engineer, less the romantic. In middle age he is, and understandably, no longer quite so astonished at the wonderful order that he had realized the fossils displayed, an astonishment of discovery which today remains the most haunting aspect of that hastily scribbled note made at the Swan Inn. But the message remains the same, however eloquent or sentimental the prose. A puzzle had been solved, a riddle unscrambled. Now was the time to make something of the answer. The Dictator in the Drawing Room. Some Romans had called what we call Bath Aquae Calidae, the hot waters. Others preferred Aquae Sulis, naming the scalding springs in homage to the presiding Celtic water deity, later twinned with their very own Minerva. And for the 2,000 years since centurions first erected their stone bathing stalls at this most convenient stopping place on the frontier between the Roman and the Celtic worlds, Bath has been an important, memorably unusual, and often very fashionable place. "Oh," exclaims Catherine Morland in Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey, "who can ever be tired of Bath?" Nowadays it's the combination of social style, elegance, and fine building stone. Tales of the costume parties of Beau Nash, the buildings of a famous father and son, both called John Wood, and the honey-coloured oolites of the Middle Jurassic, that still, in the main, impress. The tour groups line up in endless succession before the Royal Crescent and the Circus, the assembly rooms and the baths themselves, eager to revel in the pleasures of majestic architecture and public grace. Tens of thousands of visitors throng the streets, passing briefly through the compact little city within its amphitheatre of hills. It is, for tourists, one of the score of essential English way stations between the great pile of Buckingham Palace and the artless country cottage of Anne Hathaway. A few visitors come to stay, and some to study, and an even smaller number to take the hydropathic cure by drinking some of the most foul-tasting mineral waters with which the mantle's heat has ever supplied us. "Particularly unpleasant," Sam Weller had said a century ago in the Pickwick Papers. "A very strong flavour of warm flat irons." But efficacious, they used to say in the century before Dickens, and in those days the finer folk of England would flock to Bath in their thousands, and lodge, imbibe, and amuse themselves, and amuse all the envious world that looked on. But people also came to Bath to study, discuss, debate, and argue. The citizens of Bath, the population in 1800 had risen dramatically to 30,000, liked to think of themselves as inhabiting the nation's second city, in matters both social and intellectual. Few of the citizenry had forgotten that Adelard, England's first scientist, a 12th-century philosopher who had written treatises on the abacus and the astrolabe, had actually been born in Bath. Only London attracted the finer minds, just as only London had grander parties and soirées. And so in 1777 a move was made to establish and formalise the intellectual ambitions of the city by creating a society that had as its sole purpose the encouragement of the discussion and dissemination of ideas. The Bath Chronicle of August the 28th that year carried an advertisement placed by a weaver's son named Edmund Rack, and directed at "the nobility and gentry in the counties of Somerset, Gloucestershire, Wiltshire, and Dorset in general, and the cities of Bath and Bristol in particular. They were to consider, Rack wrote, a proposal for the institution of a society in this city for the encouragement of agriculture, planting, manufactures, commerce, and fine arts. The tone, flattering and seductive to the city's elite, evidently worked. 22 of the noblest and most gently born of Bath's citizenry turned up at a meeting held a week later in what would later be the Royal York Hotel, and the first of the distinguished intellectual societies for which the city would become famous was formally constituted. An impressive roll-call of luminaries chose over the years to become associated with or full members of the various new bodies: the Bath and West of England Society, the Bath Agricultural Society, the Bath Philosophical Society, the Literary Society, and today's successor to them all, the Bath Royal Literary and Scientific Institution, and the Royal Bath and West of England Society, which unhappily is now based outside Bath in Shepton Mallet. There was Joseph Priestley, who discovered oxygen, Thomas Malthus, the economist and population expert, Sir William Herschel, who discovered Uranus, lurking away at the back of the solar system, Humphrey Davy, who discovered sodium and potassium, and one Augustus Volcker, a German, who was a specialist in the chemistry of cheese and set up a school to teach cheese-making in Wells nearby. And on December the 22nd, 1796, it was announced at the annual meeting that, elected unanimously in consequence of his growing reputation for canal-making, his expertise in farming, and his keen new interest in his unromantic freelance business of solving problems with the drainage of fields, membership of the Bath and West of England Society was gained by one of the least noble and least gently born men in the city, the blacksmith's son from Oxfordshire, William Smith. His social standing was improving fast. The same annual meeting recorded that the Duke of Bedford, the Earl of Egremont, and the Earl of Peterborough, farmer aristocrats all, were in the same company as Smith, and he himself noted that in the years following he came to know each of them well. At the time of his election he had a house on a good terrace in Bath, and his more or less permanent lodgings in the Swan Inn at Dunkerton, which he used when he was delayed in the countryside on canal business. He was well paid, well regarded, sought after. And now, through the Bath Society, he found he was winning friends in influential places. Members like the Vickers, Benjamin Richardson and Joseph Townsend, both of whom were fossil collectors, owners of immense houses in the city, and travellers in the circle of the fashionable. Also fellow members like John Billingsley and Thomas Davis, the latter the land steward to the Marquis of Bath at his nearby estate at Longleat, who were at the time engaged in writing exhaustive studies of the state of local farming for the Somerset and Wiltshire Boards of Agriculture. It was this latter pair who first introduced William Smith to the notion of making maps. Although, as we shall see, history has been more generous in its assessment of the importance in William Smith's extraordinary story of the Reverends Richardson and Townsend, it was actually Billingsley and Davis who gave him the idea that would be central to his coming achievement. For while Smith had no difficulty at all in displaying the vertical extent of the geology he found, he just drew cross-sections and tables, as everyone else did, he had the very greatest difficulty in working out how to display the way in which these strata were exposed horizontally, how the outcrops of different types of rock were displayed geographically. Except that one day in late 1798 he suddenly saw just how he could do it. He was reading the latest edition of the Somerset County Agricultural Report, and there, buried without comment among the statistics on pigs and the effects of new cattle crossbreeding programs, Smith found an intriguing small map. Billingsley and Davis, it turned out, had sketched their latest in a series of maps for the report that showed, crudely but effectively, the geographical extent of each of the various soils and types of vegetation that were known in the countryside around Bath. The maps were detailed, and moreover, they were coloured, with the use of blues and yellows and greens, all painstakingly applied by hand. They showed the local forests, meadows, pastures. The maps displayed graphically all the nearby hills, rivers, and lakes, and most important for Smith, they hinted at what lay underneath the surface of the earth by showing, also in colours, the outcrops of the red earth and the courses of the coal. In a flash, Smith now realised the possibilities. If ordinary agricultural men like Billingsley and Davis were capable of making maps that could display such details, then, with his even greater graphical skills and now a good deal of new and detailed knowledge about just what lay beneath the surface, he himself could draw charts that would show the courses followed by all the rocks that he knew lay down below. He could use his skills and unusual knowledge, in other words, to draw a brand new map, the likes of which had never been known. He could draw a chart of what could not be seen, and in doing so he could create what had never been created before, a true geological map. His diary's notes showed that he then puzzled over the finest details, most important, whether he could make the maps relatively inexpensively by drawing the outcrops in black and white, by using lines of different thickness, or by using cross-hatching to illustrate the different rocks. But he decided he could not. Colour, costly though it was to print and time-consuming to apply, was in his view essential for a chart that would be so complex as a map of the unseen underworld. He thus embarked on a technique of colouring that he was to embrace for the following 30 years of his cartographic career. He decided first to start his mapping by applying his new techniques to what he knew, the area in the immediate vicinity of Bath itself. By happy chance, in the early summer of 1799, a new book was published, The Historic and Local New Bath Guide, printed by A. Taylor and W. Naylor, booksellers. Its frontispiece turned out to be a handsome map of the city, a map Smith immediately felt he could use as a base on which to superimpose what he now knew about the local geology. Taylor and Naylor's map was somewhat unusual in appearance, not least because it was circular, about 15 inches in diameter. It was on a scale of 1.5 inches to the mile, Bath lying in the centre like a bull's-eye. The Avon wandered across from northwest to southeast. The Kennet and Avon Canal was marked, as was the still-not-quite-completed Somerset Coal Canal. The countryside for 5 miles in either direction was depicted in some detail, with grand houses, stands of trees, parish churches, the turnpikes and common roads, and with alterations and improvements to the present time. It was uncoloured, and despite holding plenty of important information, was designed in a nicely uncluttered way. For William Smith's purposes, it was ideal. He promptly set to work in his Cottage Crescent house, transferring all the notes from his survey books, oolite with this particular ammonite here, lias with this lingula there, red marl with these ostrea in this valley, river deposits with clamshells there, onto the base map itself. He extrapolated his dip and strike details, made some logical postulations about where the various strata might end up, then joined the dots, and found he had created on the map a number of shapes, all enclosed and irregular-shaped bodies. They were bodies of which he could now say, and with certainty, this one shows where the oolite exists, this is the location underground of the lias. It had never been done before. The unseen world of the underground was all of a sudden on display, seeable, meant to be seen, the hitherto invisible made visible at last. And to make it not just visible, but startlingly apparent to anyone who glanced at his map, Smith then mimicked the technique of Billingsley and Davis, and hand-coloured the different bodies he had drawn. He coloured the outcrop of the oolite a rich shade of yellow, the lias the dirty blue of one of its building stones, and the red marls of the trias a brickish red. It was a colour scheme that, as it happens, has remained in place in almost all geological maps all over the world to this day. By the middle of the summer of 1799, all was done. What resulted from William Smith's labours was a map that, for all its age and weather-beaten look today, still has a strangely ethereal beauty. It may not have been of very great use. It was very limited in extent. It showed the outcrop of only 3 types of rock, and since it had no key or index, it was hardly much of a guide to the underside of the Bath countryside. But the map hangs to this day in what are still called the apartments of the Geological Society of London in Piccadilly, and though it's dwarfed by its more famous successors and therefore rarely noticed, it amply deserves to be memorialised, for it is arguably the oldest geological map worthy of its name anywhere in existence. Primitive, local and small-scale, true, but nonetheless the oldest, the map. The rubric is mostly engraved, a map of 5 miles round the city of Bath on a scale of 1.5 inches to a mile from an actual survey including all the new roads with alterations and improvements to the present time, 1799. Printed for and sold by A. Taylor and W. Naylor, booksellers, Bath. There's a handwritten edition in the elegant cursive script that over the coming years would be so familiar. Presented to the Geological Society, February the 18th, 1831, William Smith, coloured geologically in 1799. William Smith was to make still more history during that fateful year. Mary Anning may have been born that year, Vesuvius may have been erupting, the French Revolution may have been ending. But at 29 Great Pulteney Street in Bath, on the cool evening of Tuesday, June the 11th, 1799, history was being made at a small dinner party. There were only 3 guests, the Reverend Joseph Townsend, the Reverend Benjamin Richardson, and William Smith, the triumvirate, as one historian was to say later, 3 of the leading players in the heroic age of geology. As the party drew to a close, Smith is reported to have stood up, by invitation, and dictated to his host a document that is still regarded as one of the classics in the annals of science. Townsend, whose house it was, and who was thus the persuasive genius behind Smith's decision to commit his ideas to paper, was in all senses a clever, very well-connected, and most unusual man. He had trained as a doctor, but had then taken holy orders and moved into the great rectory at Pewsey in Wiltshire, which had been bought for him by his father, who was the local member of Parliament. He appears to have had the breadth of intellect for which the era's intellectual aristocracy was renowned. He taught himself Hebrew, wrote a large book on philology, was fascinated by canals, which is why Richardson first introduced him to Smith at a Bath Society meeting, and was an active member of the Regional Highways Trust, which supervised the local turnpikes. Townsend had an electrifying manner as a preacher, his voice at all times sepulchral, but when exerted, of passing loudness admirably adapted to arouse, denounce, and alarm. And for a while he was appointed personal chaplain to the headstrong Methodist aristocrat evangelist Selina Hastings. But then he had a serious falling out with her over where and when he could preach, and for several years in the 1750s he and a group of like-minded holy men who had been chaplains at her huge collection of churches were pursued by her agents in a fantastical cat-and-mouse game as they preached, without her permission, in barns and open fields and under market crosses all across the English West Country. A play was written about the affair, with Townsend satirised as the Reverend Timothy Wildgoose. He eventually fled to Ireland in 1761, and in County Kerry took up an interest, which one might think rather odd for a doctor and man of the cloth, in a mining company. He turned out to be fascinated by minerals and by fossils, and managed for the rest of his days to commingle his studies of evangelism with those of geology, to the extent that when in 1790 he published the one book for which he is known, Journey Through Spain, it was crammed with information about the geology and mineralogy of the Iberian Peninsula. Considering the fine irony involved, it bears repeating that the first remark he made when Richardson introduced him to William Smith was how much better his Spanish book might have been had he known of Smith's theories about the strata, superposition, and the use of fossils in recognising what and where they were. Richardson himself was a much less daunting figure. He was the vicar of Farley Hungerford, a living, as the job of vicar in a rural parish of the Church of England was then, and still is known, in the patronage of one Joseph Houlton, who was in turn to become a keen supporter of Smith and his map-making endeavours. Richardson was also the owner of a huge old library and collection of fossils and rock samples in his home, Farley Castle. Richardson met Smith at a gathering of the Agricultural Society. They talked about fossils, and Richardson invited the younger man home to inspect the collection that he had amassed. It was then that the first connection was made, the serendipitous meshing of one set of skills with another. For while Richardson had a magnificent collection of fossils in his townhouse on Lisbon Terrace in Bath, he had no idea which belonged where in the order of strata, no clue as to which lived earlier and which later. All the fossils were as a result jumbled together or put into drawers not according to their relative age but according to their type. all the ammonites placed on one shelf, all belemnites on another, all crinoids here, all graptolites there, all brachiopods in one compartment, and so on. When Smith inspected the fossil cabinet, he was both appalled and challenged. He told Richardson that, if he was allowed, he could organise the vicar's collection so that all the fossils would be arranged in their correct, logical, properly created stratigraphical order, with the oldest and least advanced at the bottom, the most sophisticated and complex and youngest at the top. Richardson, who could barely tell one fossil from another, readily agreed. So the young man set to work, and within a day the entire amassment of the amateur paleontologist vicar had been rendered into a scientifically accurate column by the efforts of this extraordinary surveyor professional. Richardson was by all accounts astonished. No diary records his words, but Smith later said that he explained to Richardson that what he had showed him applied everywhere, and not just to the fossiliferous rocks and specimens in this one collection. "No," he said, and this, for the first time to a man with at least some scientific training, "the same strata are always found in the same order of superposition, and they always contain the same peculiar fossils." Richardson grasped in an instant the importance of what was being said. He immediately made contact with his friend Townsend, who suggested that Smith's theories be put to the test. If Smith was right, then he should be able to predict with some accuracy what rocks would appear and what fossils would be found on both the slopes and at the summit of a prominent nearby hill where Dundry Church had been built. Smith rose to the task. From his calculations, he reckoned that the hills would be capped by the limestones of the inferior oolite, and that on the western side of the hill it would be possible to find a series of very specific fossils peculiar to what is now known as the Lower Jurassic. So the three men hired a horse-drawn carriage and hurried northward to Dundry Hill. Every few minutes they stopped the coach, climbed down, inspected the outcrops of rock, and on every single occasion, in terms of outcrop, thickness, lithology, and fossil content, William Smith was right. "The effect of this was decisive," wrote a contemporary biographer of Smith. "In general literature, and especially in natural history, Mr. Smith was immeasurably surpassed by his friends. But they acknowledged that from his labours in a different quarter, a new light had begun to manifest itself in the previously dark horizons of geology, and they set themselves earnestly to make way for its auspicious influence." The dinner at Great Pulteney Street that evening was a classic example of such men earnestly making way for the coming effects of Smith's thinking. It's not known what was eaten, or what, if anything, was drunk. What is known is that the three men spent much of the time discussing what they had just found at Dundry, what Smith had accomplished with the collections at Farley Castle, what theories had now been tested, proved, and confirmed. It remained now, at least in the view of Joseph Townsend, to make a tabular list of the strata of which the three men were well aware, a summary, in fact, of all they knew about the region's rocks and where each fitted in with respect to all the others. Richardson and Townsend sat at the dining table, now cleared of all china and glassware. A large piece of paper, the size of a blotting sheet, about 26 by 34 inches, was placed on the surface. Townsend took out his quill pen and sand shaker. Smith gave him a ruler, and with this he drew five long lines across the page, one of them horizontal, four of them vertical. Above the horizontal lines, and in the five boxes thus created by the intersections with the vertical rules and the paper edges, Townsend then wrote, according to Smith's dictation, strata, thickness, springs, fossils, petrifactions, etc., etc., and finally, descriptive characters and situations. Smith then cleared his throat and began his dictation. The list that followed enumerated 23 horizons, 23 bands of rock that were sufficiently different from one another and recognisable from the fossils within them to be counted as separate and unique. The list began with the youngest, and it ended with the oldest. It began with the chalk, which Smith listed as number one, and ended with the coal, squeezed in almost as an afterthought, at the very bottom of the page, as number 23. In between were 21 strata of rocks that had, in many cases, hitherto passed unnamed and unnoted, Now, at a scratch of Joseph Townsend's pen and a shake of the blotting sand, they were formally christened by William Smith. Not all were given names. The first four below the chalk were merely described by their lithologies. The names that some older horizons were given did not go down well. The geological establishment of the day suggested that some of the appellations were crude, and worst of all to the refined manners of the times, abominably ugly. Nonetheless, in many cases, the names have stuck, and at least four of them remain in scientific use in England today. Below the 300 feet of chalk, Smith declaimed before the others were first 70 feet of sand, then 30 feet of clay, then 30 feet more of clay and stone, and 15 feet of clay, then 10 feet of the first of the named rocks, forest marble. Next, 60 feet of freestone, a narrow band no more than 6 feet thick of blue clay, and then only another 8 of yellow clay. Then, most familiar still today, 6 feet of what would be called Fuller's Earth, and 80 feet of what Smith called bastard Fuller's Earth, complete with fossils, striated cardia, mitolites, anomii, pundibs, and duck mussels, that the narrow band above did not contain. Below that came the stratum labelled number 12, 30 feet of freestone, then 30 feet of sand, 40 of blue marl, 25 of blue lias, 15 of white lias, 15 of marlstone, 180 feet of the much-vaunted red ground, or red earth, or red marl, depending on where Smith was writing and to whom, and millstone, followed by an unrecorded thickness of pennant stone, then a band of grey stones, another of cliff, whatever that might be, though whatever it was crammed with ferns, olive stellate plants, Threnax parviflora, or dwarf fern palm of Jamaica, and which trended almost imperceptibly into the lowest horizon, the coal. The biggest change between any of the strata was the one that occurred between the millstone and the pennant stone. Beneath the millstone bed, dictated Smith, no fossil, shells, or animal remains are found. Above it, no vegetable impressions. The boundary between the two, Smith had already noticed, was unconformable. That it had so vastly different a fossil population, only animal remains above, only plant remains below, indicates something we know only too well today, that this unconformity marks a vitally important geological boundary. It was the base of the Permo-Triassic period of geologic time and the top of the Carboniferous period. It was, and is, in other words, a highly observable, universally recognized, and now internationally agreed moment in the Earth's long and unstoppable history, and William Smith, Joseph Townsend, and Benjamin Richardson were the first men to witness the newly discovered fact of this moment being committed to paper. The record written that evening would ensure that this geological junction point would remain in human beings' knowledge of their world and of themselves forever. For the first time, the Earth had a provable history, a written record that paid no heed or obeisance to religious teaching and dogma, that declared its independence from the kind of faith that is no more than the blind acceptance of absurdity. A science, an elemental basic science, that would in due course allow mankind to exploit the almost limitless treasures of the underworld, had at last broken free from the age-old constraints of doctrine and canonical instruction. From now on, armed with a new knowledge and understanding of how matters were arranged below the Earth's surface, human beings could begin to explore their planet from a different perspective, and with an intellectual freedom that would in time permit them to look for and then to find astonishing things. The reverberations of that late evening meeting can be felt distinctly down all the years. Each time a new oil field is opened, or new gold is added to a reserve, or when more platinum, or cerium, or iron, or manganese is won from the Earth's crust, it's perhaps appropriate to remember these three men. To remember them, and to savour the irony that, while Townsend and Richardson worked that night under the leadership of William Smith, whose agnosticism was well known, they themselves were churchmen, making this particular bid for intellectual freedom an act of brave defiance, and one of which their bishops would doubtless disapprove. Yet, though the Church may have briefly frowned, all humankind went on to benefit. The trio finished the document at midnight, and they made 3 fair copies. They called it The Order of the Strata and Their Embedded Organic Remains in the Vicinity of Bath, Examined and Proved Prior to 1799. Wrote a Bath city historian of the time, each person took 1 copy and was encouraged to make further copies as necessary. There was, the historian added, no stipulation as to the use which should be made of it, and accordingly it was extensively distributed and remained for a long period the type and authority for the descriptions and order of superposition of the strata near Bath. We are not sure exactly who received copies, except in 1 or 2 cases. Benjamin Richardson, for example, acting to fulfil Smith's wishes that the discovery be made universally known, gave, without reserve, a card of the English strata to Baron Rosencrantz, Dr. Muller of Christiania, and many others in the year 1801. Smith was pleasantly surprised a couple of years later when a geologist named William Reynolds turned up in Bath from Coalbrookdale in the West Midlands and told Smith that copies of his table of strata, of which he had one, were circulating among the educated classes in both the East and the West Indies. William Smith had made his observations, had formulated his theory, had tested his ideas, had been proved correct, and was now publishing his notions for the world to read. He was already socially established. Now he was on the verge of what no Oxfordshire country boy could ever have imagined. Adulation and fame. Yet, at almost the same moment as he verged on triumph, so William Smith was sowing the wind, of which he would eventually reap the whirlwind. He had, it'll be remembered, bought for himself an attractive small estate, the Tucking Mill House, at Midford. He had a mortgage for the not insubstantial sum of £1,300, and he was under contract to pay an annual sum to the owner, a Mr. Connolly. At the same time he made the purchase, he was fully employed by the Somerset Coal Canal Company, and he had both a generous salary and guaranteed expenses. But on Wednesday, June the 5th, 1799, William Smith was abruptly and unceremoniously fired. It has never been entirely clear why. One suggestion has it that he disagreed violently with the way the canal was being built, and in particular over the decision to construct a mechanical lifting device, instead of a flight of locks, to bypass a hill near the village of Coombe Hay. A more popular explanation is that the directors found an unacceptable conflict of interest in his purchasing of Tucking Mill, which lay beside the canal, at the very time he was engaged in buying land for the canal's passage. It seems that he approached Connolly with a view to buying land for the canal right-of-way, and asked him if he might throw in a few extra acres for himself at the same time, if true, a somewhat imprudent act that might reasonably be expected to at least raise some canal company eyebrows. Whatever the reason, the company asked him to leave, quickly, and with little fuss or ceremony, and no suggestion of a pension or golden handshake. A job that had brought him almost £450 a year was brought to a sudden end. The firing, even though Smith does not appear to have contested it, unsettled him gravely, and his letters of the time show him to have become briefly angry and embittered. But by the end of the year he seems to have settled somewhat, and by the time he had his famous dinner at Great Pulteney Street, he was his old self, brimming with self-confidence and ambition. Except that in retrospect there appears to have been more than a touch of hubris about him, for below the surface matters were beginning, if slowly, to unwind. His financial affairs were starting to unravel. Those who would eventually come to cheat him and try to deprive him of the honours he was rightly due were beginning to gather and to circle. He would never have full-time, fixed employment again. His 6 years with the Canal Company marked the summit of his career as a company man. From now on he'd be in the perilous position of the freelance mineral surveyor, earning as much as his wits and his contacts might bring him. He didn't know it yet, but he was fast standing into danger. And yet it was just at this time, when matters were beginning to go awry, that he began to work on the biggest project of them all. He had made the first geological map in the world of the country around Bath. Now he began to consider the possibilities of making a map not just of a region, but of an entire country. He wanted nothing less than to know and to map the underworld of all of England. The Great Map Conceived. Each age has a defining set of reference books, that small collection of timeless volumes that is deemed essential to any household that considers itself intelligent and civilized. Today it might include Britannica, the OED, or Brewer's, with additionally, for the more specialized mind, perhaps Wisden, the Statesman's Yearbook, or the Cook's Continental. A century ago, the moderately curious household might have had on hand volumes of Whitaker's, Pear's, or Cruden's Concordance, and most certainly a dog-eared edition of a Bradshaw. In the 18th century, the choice would necessarily have been more limited. One would certainly possess, after its mid-century publication date, the two-volume edition of Johnson's Dictionary. And if one ever contemplated taking a postchaise and venturing from home, it would be essential also to have access to a copy of the best-known atlas of the day, what was widely known as a Carey. John Carey, little known today beyond the rarefied world of the antiquarian map dealer, occupies an ineradicable reputation as the leading mapmaker of the 18th and early 19th centuries. He was only 24 when he created his first engraved plan in 1779, a starkly beautiful, rather plain design that offered something very different from the gaudy, curlicued and highly confusing maps and charts that were the fashion of the day. His work proved popular, so much so that by 1787, when he produced his first map collection, the New and Correct English Atlas, it became the essential reference volume that households were to possess well into the next century. Servants in London were commonly sent out to Hatchards in Piccadilly, their masters demanding simply that they collect a Carey. So many editions were produced of his atlas that the printing plates had to be re-engraved more than once, so worn with demand did they become. The creator of these elegant and highly accurate works achieved a towering reputation. The General Post Office was one of the first to recognize John Carey's cartographic brilliance. In 1794 it commissioned him to make a comprehensive survey of all main roads in England and Wales, a task that required him to walk the length of each, pushing a measuring device, a stick with a 4-inch wheel at the business end, in front of him. The resulting book, Carey's New Itinerary, was published in 1798. It was while Carey was working on the Post Office Commission that he and William Smith first met. It would be pleasing to imagine that they encountered each other out in the field. The Oxfordshire blacksmith's son, hammer and acid bottle and compass in hand, meeting the Wiltshire maltster's son with his measuring rod and notebook. Perhaps they would have met somewhere near Midford, where the Foss Way, which was being surveyed by Carey, crosses the Coal Canal, which was being surveyed by Smith. But it seems more likely that they actually met in London. Perhaps they did so during the 1794 parliamentary inquiry that resulted in the grant to the Canal Company of the right to begin excavation. But whenever and wherever it was that the two men first met, Smith and Carey began in 1794 in Somerset a collaboration that was to last, happily if not necessarily profitably, for much of the next 40 years. It was a collaboration that began with the quarter-inch survey charts of the canal itself, which were engraved by Carey, the Canal Company's obvious choice since he was so well known and well regarded, and had engineering and some geological details superimposed by Smith, and it culminated in publication of the great national geological maps and atlases that lie at the heart of this story. Wisely, or perhaps timorously, William Smith decided to begin his efforts to map the entire country in a relatively small way. By this time in his life he had a fair knowledge of the countryside and the geology of the counties in which he had worked, either for the Canal Company or for Edward Webb. He can fairly be said to have known, well enough to make a stab at some rudimentary geological cartography, the lie of the land in Oxfordshire, Warwickshire, Worcestershire, Gloucestershire, Wiltshire, and Hampshire. He knew very well indeed now the deep geology of northeastern Somerset. He had been to the capital many times, and he could tell at a glance by the dramatic gradations, dramatic to him alone, perhaps, in scenery, soil, and vegetation, the progress he was making from the lower Jurassic to the upper Cretaceous every time he journeyed by coach from the circus in Bath to Charing Cross in London. He'd been to Newcastle-upon-Tyne, too, and had a passing acquaintance with the underpinnings of Rutland and Lincolnshire, Northamptonshire, Yorkshire, Durham, and southern Northumberland, enough knowledge, in short, to have a tentative go at making a map of the whole country, albeit on a very small scale. He chose as his base map a copy of, not a real map at all, but John Carey's index sheet to the second edition of the 70-sheet New and Correct Atlas of England and Wales, published in 1794. On this index sheet, which displayed Britain up to the Scottish borders at a scale of about 47 miles to the inch, and on which it's possible to see the superimposed numbers of the sheets to which the index refers, Smith coloured in what he imagined to be the extents of a number of geological formations, the tertiaries, the chalk, the coral rag and carstone, the oolites, the lias, the red ground, the magnesian limestone, the coal measures, and the carboniferous limestone. On his map and in his notes, he gave names to those rocks that did not already have the dignity. The cornbrash, the forest marble, the lias, still survive, a system of names almost barbarous to ears polite, wrote one critic. Years later, when the honours began to cascade down on Smith, a distinguished professor offering him a medal was tactless enough to remark on the uncouth names he had given to the rocks. Yet some of the more barbaric and less couth names have gone, mercifully. The horizon that is now known as the Oxford clay was in Smith's notes called the Clunch clay, surely one of the least agreeable rock names that can be imagined. He worked on his map through the early months of 1801, colouring it in with the information he had gathered on his stagecoach and postchaise and walking journeys, using the same system of coloration he had initiated with the circular Bath map, though as he was now dealing with six or seven rock formations, not just the three he had coloured before, he had to be more chromatically creative. So he chose grey bands for the tertiary outcrop, blue-green for the chalk, brown for the coral rag and carstone, yellow for the oolites, Prussian blue for the lias, and red, not surprisingly, for the red ground. In addition to the simple fact of colouring the strata, admittedly most boldly so, he also incorporated a further device that he felt would make an even greater impression on the eye. He shaded each of the colours away from the lowest part of their outcrop, so that at the base, as in the oolites where they rest on the next lowest or next most westerly bed, the lias, the colour is strong and fades slowly away until the junction with the rock stratum above it, which is similarly strongly coloured and fades away too. So the lias is dark blue at its lowest point, faded to pale blue. There's an inked-in line, and suddenly there is the oolite, bold yellow, and joining starkly and suddenly with the outcrop below. It then fades slowly away too, until, after a further inked-in line, there, in deep chocolate brown, stands the coral rag, which fades in its own turn, until it encounters the vivid blue-green of the Cretaceous, and so on. The technique was time-consuming, and it isn't used today. That Smith decided on it suggests that, with a limited budget for colours and plenty of time on his hands, in the aftermath of losing his job with the canal, he did his best to make his map dramatic-looking, even if it wasn't the kind of technique that would ever lend itself to mass production or publication. He completed his work by writing in his best copperplate the map's title, adding to Carey's engraved phrase, General Map, the words, Of Strata in England and Wales, and signing the work by W. Smith, 1801. It all looks more than a little rough-hewn and embryonic, as indeed it was. This map was only a sketch, a cartoon for a major cartographic task that Smith knew he was not yet up to attempting. He made at least two further experiments with small-scale maps later in the year. Each one was a little more advanced, with Smith either remembering new details or finding in his notebooks fresh data, or hearing from Richardson or Townsend or his other amateur geologist friends some new piece of information, or being given some new fossil sample or some new piece of outcrop with a good fresh edge, weathering free and from a known and fixed location, all information from which he might make some useful identification that would further enrich the information on the chart. Perhaps the best of these three 1801 maps which can surely count as being Britain's first ever national geological maps, and thus the first useful such documents made of any country anywhere, is the one which Smith formally presented to the Geological Society of London in 1831. It hangs there still, honoured, but essentially forgotten, for though very old indeed, it is much duller in aspect and very much smaller and less distinctive than the giant map of 1815, which hangs nearby and for which Smith is more deservedly famous. The small map at the Society's headquarters does not actually use a Carey sheet as its base, but a rather larger scale chart, about 37 miles to the inch, of England and Wales that was taken from a world atlas published by one of Carey's rivals, Robert Wilkinson. On this, Smith has coloured seven strata. The chalk is in green, the coral rag in purple, a stratum that he calls the Clunch Clay is coloured here in a grey wash, the oolite freestone in its now traditional yellow, the lias limestone in blue, the red ground in red, and finally a hodgepodge of pre-carboniferous strata that would now be equated with the old red sandstone of the Devonian, which Smith calls by its Welsh name Red Rab, coloured in a burgundy-brown wash.